Good morning. As some of you may remember, 4 years ago, I started a tradition that in my first sermon of each year, I would feature the life of a person who, because of his or her commitment to living their faith, changed the world for the better. When it came time this year to choose a Christian whose faith made a difference for good, an offhand sentence in something I was reading mentioned Florence Nightingale as an example of a person of faith. Reading this caused me to stop and think that I'd heard her name all my life, but really knew almost nothing about her, except that she had something to do with nursing. It didn't take much study to uncover that she was a pretty amazing person who had accomplished great things. So, Florence Nightingale, and where faith took her, will be the subject of this sermon. She seems an appropriate subject this year because, living under the cloud of this COVID-19 pandemic for months, has prompted us to be keenly aware of the heroic part healthcare workers of all kinds, but perhaps particularly nurses, have played in fighting this terrible menace. So many people have worked tirelessly, sacrificially, and with so much compassion to bring aid and comfort to people afflicted with this disease, and really anyone in need of care. But on to Florence Nightingale. Born May 12, 1820, she was named for the place of her birth, Florence, Italy. Her older sister, not so lucky, was named Parthenope, in honor of the suburb of Naples, where she was born. Her parents, Win and Fanny Smith Nightingale, actually were British citizens, and they were on their 3-year honeymoon at the time of their daughter's birth. They were wealthy, as you could probably guess, from their ability to take 3-year honeymoons. They were not nobility, but one step below, and quite comfortably accepted in the highest society in England. If you're familiar with shows like Downton Abbey, you'd recognize their lifestyle, which involved lots of servants, a home in the country and a home in London, formal dress for dinner, tea parties, balls, hunting, etc. Wynne had actually been born when William Edward Shore in humbler circumstances, but changed his last name to Nightingale when he inherited his great-uncle Peter Nightingale's estate. It's just as well, because Florence Nightingale has more of a ring to it than Florence Shore. There is nothing to indicate that Florence's childhood was different than any other privileged English girl child. Romantic biographies like to feature her tenderly ministering to her dollies and bandaging dogs' paws, but there is no evidence to support this notion. Girls were not educated at this time. She would have been taught to read and write, but her education from then on would have consisted of learning to embroider, crochet, play the piano, and oil paint. Fortunately, her father was well educated and willing to share that education with his daughters. Parthenope proved uninterested, but Florence lapped it up. Wynne spent 7 years teaching Florence Latin and Greek and history and British Constitution and whatever else he could think of. A family friend taught her math, which she loved. She, wanting nothing more than to keep on learning, was in all ways ready for Oxford or Cambridge, except for one important thing. She was a female, decades before women were accepted into British universities. What was expected of her was to settle down, find an acceptable husband, have a few babies, and spend her days embroidering and gossiping with friends, and her evenings entertaining and dancing. Boy, was Florence not interested, and telling everybody so loudly and on all possible occasions. Her mother, unmoved by her complaining, forced the 18-year-old Florence to be presented at court to Queen Victoria, and to then endure the social season and the whole society routine. The family traveled in Europe and just generally went to all the right places and saw all the right people. Florence was outraged by the emptiness and the vapidness of it all. But something else was stirring in Florence besides boredom and a sense of the futility of her life. She had always been a religiously serious child. She'd attended the traditional Church of England with her mother, but had been influenced by her father's Unitarian intellectual world. Unitarians, even to this day, are very strong in their desire to help the poor. Florence felt this duty keenly. Her father's estate included a village and many tenant farmers. She made it her responsibility to care for them when they were in need. She even taught a school for their young children. Yet, she wanted to do more. That desire intensified when, at the age of 17, she experienced a spiritual awakening that she described as a special call from God to help the poor. Florence's problem was that she didn't know what exactly God wanted her to do. She felt especially drawn to health-related needs, of which there was an avalanche to choose from. She decided that she would go to London and serve as a nurse. She was undeterred by the fact that in the hospitals of that time, a nurse was almost always an unfortunate woman, barely, if at all, one step above a prostitute. So few ways existed for women without means to eke out an existence, but nursing, as it was called, was a possibility. We should note that this was not nursing as we know it today, but more like being an orderly or a cleaning woman. You can imagine how this announcement went over with her family. She didn't go, but she anguished in despair as only a teenager can. She was positive God wanted her to do something, but she didn't know what. So Florence turned to spiritual people she trusted for advice. What should she do? Each of them advised her to wait and watch because God would make it known to her what he wanted her to do. She continued to do what she could for the people in need within her small orbit, but she hated the social life she was forced to participate in and was depressed. She was not without suitors and admirers. One young man who was intelligent, kind, committed to good works, and whom she liked very much, hung on for 7 years before he gave up after she'd refused his proposal. Florence more than half regretted saying no. If he'd ask again, she probably would have accepted, but he was out of patience. Florence received what she thought a second call from God 12 years after the first, and a third 2 years after that. 14 years is a long time to spend confused, frustrated, and thwarted from doing what you interpret as a calling from God. She didn't take this waiting well. Her letters and other writings indicate a soul in turmoil. However, her time spent in limbo wasn't entirely unproductive. Everywhere she traveled, she visited hospitals and other health-related institutions and took copious notes. She started making drawings and writing up plans for how to improve healthcare facilities. She also discovered a private hospital in Kaiserswerth, Germany, that included a staff of trained deaconesses who cared for the patients. She was so impressed that she managed to sneak in a 2-week visit and later a 3-month internship. This would be the only more or less training that she would ever receive, but she made the most of it. Before Kaiserswerth, the only women nurses, besides the erstwhile ladies of the night variety she had seen, were nuns. Florence admired the nuns and had even made an attempt to join them. However, the Catholic bishop she had approached had discouraged her, knowing that Florence's religious beliefs were not at all Roman Catholic, but knowing even more that she would never be able to give herself over to complete obedience to a mother superior. Drawing from her experience at Kaiserswerth and her observations of the nuns working in the Catholic hospitals, Florence started putting together her own plans for what nursing should be. She believed that nurses should be educated as well as trained, and special schools designed to do just that. She saw nursing as a separate profession, with nurses over nurses, and not just as foot soldiers for the doctors. She thought they should wear uniforms, as the nuns did, and that they should take pride in their appearance. I suspect scrubs with Mickey and Minnie Mouse all over them would horrify her, but she wasn't necessarily right about everything. She also believed they should be paid well, befitting the trained and educated professionals that they were. If this all sounds pretty commonplace to us today, it is in large part because Florence Nightingale worked very hard to make her vision come true. But I'm getting ahead of my story. In 1851, Florence met Dr. Elizabeth Blackwell, an English woman who had gone to the United States and obtained a medical degree, the first woman in the United States to do so. She had returned to England to live and practice when she and Florence crossed paths. The two of them became lifelong friends. Dr. Blackwell appears to have done what I kept wanting to do the whole time I was reading about Florence's early years. She told her to quit mooning around waiting for signs about how she was to help the poor and get out there and do something. God speaking to her three times ought to be enough for anybody. So Florence did. Fortunately, by now, her father was supportive. Another good thing that had been happening while Florence spent 14 years fretting about in the clutches of her family was something she probably took so for granted that she didn't even know it was an advantage until later. She'd been networking without even knowing it. Everyone who was anyone in England would have been at her dinner table or in her drawing room, or she at theirs. That boring society she had so scorned turned out to be a huge advantage to her and her causes for the rest of her life. Florence's long-awaited chance to strike out on her own finally arrived in 1853. She was accepted to be the unpaid superintendent of the Anglican Institution for the Care of Sick Gentlewomen in Distressed Circumstances. Most of these gentlewomen were governesses who had been paid a pittance and now were either old or too ill to work anymore. The place was in terrible shape, physically and organizationally, situations Florence had been preparing for years. She took over and whipped things into shape quickly. She also made it clear to the board of directors that women of the Catholic faith would be accepted too, or she would leave. She fought prejudice as assiduously as she did dirty linen and unemptied slop jars. She knew that God meant everyone when he commanded her to help the poor, and not just the white Anglican ones. The gentle women loved her dearly. Within a year, a cholera outbreak erupted in London. Florence volunteered at the nearest hospital, endangering her life to do so, but she didn't come down with the disease. She was at all times a stickler for cleanliness, a trait which probably saved her life more than once. At this time, England, aligned with France, was engaged in war, helping the Turks fight the Russians in the Crimea. It is mind-boggling and depressing beyond words to think that the Russians are still fighting over this same piece of land 170 years later. This was a very unpopular war, made more so by reports that thousands more English soldiers were dying from diseases and poor care than from the actual fighting itself. The French soldiers were faring much better, partly because France was sending in the Sisters of Mercy, as the Catholic nuns were known, to staff their hospitals. The British public demanded to know why their young men had no Sisters of Mercy to give them better care. Sir Sidney Herbert was the Secretary of War at the time, and receiving the brunt of all this criticism. He also was a close friend of the Nightingales and aware of the amazing turnaround Florence had spearheaded at the Institute for the Care of Sick Gentle Women in Distress. Amidst the great skepticism of almost everyone, he asked Florence to put together a team to go to the war zone and attack this problem. Within 4 days, Florence had recruited 38 women to serve under her as nurses and had set sail for Turkey and the Barracks Hospital in Scutari in what is now Istanbul. She had very little formal training or nursing experience, but she had many unproven theories and opinions that have since been proven right, and the firm conviction that this was exactly what God had been calling her to do. She was finally going to be given the opportunity to help the needy in a consequential way. The hospital in Scutari must have been a shock to Florence and her 38 recruited nurses. It was filthy, dirty, and terrible disrepair, and had been mistakenly built over a sewer that was full of rats. The bodies were packed in so tightly that a person couldn't walk between them. The supplies that had been sent to them hadn't arrived, so the men were hungry, without blankets or even adequate clothing. Their wounds were festering without medical attention. Diseases were rampant. Florence sprang into action. Nurses boiled water to start disinfecting and cleaning. The men were all given baths, using a clean cloth for each man, which was a very new innovation. Dressings were changed and medications given. Florence soon was tracking down the lost supplies, had a kitchen built on the building so the nurses could cook nourishing food for the men. She used her own money, if she had to make sure everyone was clothed and had a blanket. She saw to it that repairs were made to the building and windows were added to provide ventilation. She had privacy screens installed so that medical procedures could be performed without the entire hospital as an audience. When she observed that the bored, lonely men were drinking too much alcohol, causing medical and morale problems, she set up coffee houses and reading rooms so they would have alternatives to the bars. She also worked on a way for them to send money home so they could put their paychecks to better use. This all sounds like routine stuff to us, yet in 1854, much of what she introduced was innovative and not always welcomed. She learned to ignore criticism, fight red tape and bureaucracy, and navigate political minefields. She made enemies, but she never wavered. She was doing the Lord's work, exactly what he had called her to do. And the men loved her. It was mostly because of their admiration that, much to her dismay, the Florence Nightingale legend arose, and hers became a household name. Soldiers returning to England told everyone about this kind, beneficent angel who had ministered to them, helping to heal them and make them comfortable. At Scutari, it had become her custom, as Jenny was telling us, to make the rounds, checking on each patient every night before she went to bed, carrying an oil lamp to light the way. Each man received a kind word, a gentle pat, a soothed brow, and they were deeply moved by her thoughtfulness. Word of her beneficence soon spread all over England. It was a sentimental time, so it was no surprise that songs and poems soon sprang up about the Lady of the Lamp. Someone who knew about her interest in establishing a school to train nurses started a fund to give to her for that purpose. It had gathered the equivalent of over $1 million before she arrived back from Turkey. Florence, however, had spent the last year of the war inspecting other hospitals in the war zone and learning more about the medical care of soldiers. Amongst the last to leave Turkey, she returned to a hero's welcome and was chagrined and felt awkward. She firmly believed we are to do God's work humbly, gratefully, and without fanfare. All the hoopla made her very uncomfortable. She also was not ready to start a school for nursing, although it was in her plans to do so in the future. What she saw as the immediate need and the first step was to overhaul the hospital system. Having seen the military up close, she also felt keenly that the lot of the common British soldier was intolerable, and she felt an obligation to her boys to fight for reforms. The whole situation became even more confused when it became apparent that she was very ill. Probably she had brucellosis, a serious bacterial infection that she would have contracted by eating tainted meat or drinking infected milk. Whatever it was, it pretty much put her to bed for the rest of her life, and she lived to be 90. Some scholars suggest that perhaps it was psychosomatic, because it did have the effect of removing her from the social scene she so hated, and the prospect of accepting all the honors and accolades she did not want. But I think she was too spirited a person to give up her active, hands-on, take-no-prisoners approach to life if she didn't have to. She would have figured out how to circumvent the social morass if something hadn't felled her. Florence may have been down, but she wasn't out. She set up camp in her home and continued her work from her bed or couch. She called in experts, drew up plans, invited in influential people, and used her contacts to make proposals to Parliament. Her old friend, Sir Sidney Herbert, was her main collaborator, but she had many others. Over time, she was able to see a sizable number of her ideas accepted and reforms come to pass. She also kept pressing until she got results for more humane treatment for the soldiers. She became interested in India, a country that was part of the British Empire at that time, and a country with enormous injustices and inequality among its native population. She sent in teams to be her eyes and ears, and she came up with many proposals to make life better for poor Indians. To the despair of family and friends, she worked tirelessly, refusing to take vacations or break for relaxation. She was doing the work that God called her to do, and it was serious business. People's lives depended on it. She had no patience with anyone who couldn't understand that. The Florence Nightingale School of Nursing had been set up using the money donated for that purpose, without much help from Florence, although she was marginally involved. Eventually, she put aside her plans and pie charts, and by the way, she invented pie charts, although she called them corkscrews, and took a good look at the school. She didn't like what she saw, so she closed it down and started another school, more to her approval. Florence continued to work with her school, helping to establish the proud field of nursing, to fight for hospital innovations and modernizations, to promote sanitation and health reforms, and to generally improve the lives of poor people everywhere, almost until the day she died at age 90. She's buried in her family plot in East Wellow, Hampshire, under a simple stone that reads F.N. Born 12 May 1820, died 13 August 1910. So Florence Nightingale, a person who, because of her faith and dedication to serving her Lord, changed the world for the better. She is not only the visionary and founder of our modern-day nursing profession, but she influenced the design and operation of our hospitals. Many of her innovations, like centralized nursing stations and sanitary methods, are still being used today. She invented ways to track diseases that changed the course of healthcare. She also influenced the welfare infrastructure system in an attempt to make life healthier and more comfortable for the poor. She may have been a late bloomer, but once she got started, she made up for lost time. The thing is, we all make a difference in this world, whether we want to or not. It's up to us to prove whether it will be for good or bad, and what it will be. We don't have to wait for a special call, because we've already gotten it. In Ephesians 5, 1 through 2, Paul tells us, "Follow God's example, therefore, as dearly loved children, and walk in the way of love, just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. In John, Florence's favorite book of the Bible, we read in 14:15, "If you love me, keep my commandments." John 13:13-17 reads, "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. Very truly, I tell you, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." Florence's own touchstone verse was John 4:34. "My food," said Jesus, "is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work." Jesus, quoting Isaiah, made his mission even clearer in Luke 18:18-19. "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." These verses make it obvious that we too have our call and our marching orders. We are to be like Jesus. We are to keep his commandments by spreading the good news, seeking justice, feeding the poor, and walking in love. We must be strong. These are very troubled times. But by living God's commandments, we too can make a difference for the good.
You've been listening to Joanne Trammell at Hayes Christian Church. Hayes Christian Church is a non-denominational fellowship in Hayes, Kansas. We are supported by the generosity of our members, attenders, and friends. The financial support we raise goes to projects which further spread the gospel to those who do not yet know Jesus, to those local, national, and international missions, and they help to keep those podcasts free. If you'd like to share a monetary gift with us, please visit our webpage at hayeschristianchurch.org and click on the donate button, or you may mail your gift to P.O. Box 1111, Hayes, Kansas 67601. If you have questions, comments, or would like more information, we would love to hear from you. Simply go to our webpage and click on the Contact Us form. Thank you for your generosity, and may God bless you as you seek to follow Him.